I'm continuing the interview with Paul Davey. Today is the 7th of June 2011. And Paul, to begin with, I'd like to ask, is there anything arising from the previous session that you'd like to comment on or correct?
Just a couple of points, Barry, if I may. I noticed, and I don't know whether the times that I've got here are accurate, but anyway, on the first CD, at about 24.30 minutes in, I say that Charlie Horsfall's mother was married to a farmer. It should be Charlie Horsfall's mother's sister. Her name was Hope Stewart, and she was married to the farmer Stewart. So that's one correction. At about 30 minutes in, I say that my uncle wasn't well, that he'd got tuberculosis in his legs. Well, that should have been thrombosis in his legs, not tuberculosis. On the second CD, 12-15 minutes in, I talk about sharing a flat above the Exchange Hotel in Wagga with a guy called Williams, who subsequently became my best man. His name is actually Mike Williams, and I should have remembered that at the time. Mike Williams, were still very good friends. Just a couple of other points that I haven't previously mentioned. On the second CD, if I may just make these points, having docked in Sydney on the 19th of April 1966 and gone to Wagga, I was quite surprised to receive call-up papers to register for national service. That was in January 1967. It just hadn't occurred to me that I might be required to do national service. And of course, the Vietnam War was on. I didn't mind at all having received them. I had no objection to it. And in fact, I thought, well, you know, a stint in the army, given my previous interest in the military, might be quite fun. So I registered. I received my registration certificate. It was dated the 27th of January 1967. The registration number, and I've still got it to this day, 1068272, and I kept that because the strict instruction on the card was to keep it in a safe place. I also on this tape refer to this television show I've Got a Secret, which was being recorded in Brisbane, and I talk about seeing a young lady on the program and then again at Brisbane Airport. And I say that her name was Lindy McGregor. She came from Orange, and make the point that she and I were subsequently married. It sort of begs the question of what was her secret on the program, and hers was actually a lot more interesting than ours in that she had hitchhiked through Vietnam on her own at the height of the Tet Offensive in 1967, which was no small feat, especially for a young woman travelling, as I say, on her own. She was on her way back from a world trip, and she got quite a bit of publicity on it, front page cover on People magazine and things like that. So it's just that's it. Yeah.
Thank you for being so thorough. And I believe that we're in adopting a chronological approach to this interview. We're now up to about 1969. And I'm very interested in how it was you came to end up in London working as a journalist that year.
Yeah, we, having got married in 68, and we then came back to Sydney and went back to work. My wife Lindy worked with Kay's rent-a-car, as a rent-a-car chick in William Street, and I was still with Australian United Press. And we sort of got to the point, she had travelled extensively before. She still had a bit of a travel bug, if you like. And I was reaching the stage where, I guess like a lot of young journos at that time, the idea of trying to work on Fleet Street was appealing. So we decided we'd go over to the UK and I'd have a go at that. We didn't have much money. The cheapest way to get to England at that stage, and we left in February, was to travel by boat up to Japan and then get a connecting boat from Japan across to Vladivostok and then get the Trans-Siberian Railway across Russia. And that was the cheapest way to get there. And we did this. We turned up at the Pyrmont dock in Sydney to find that the boat that was going to Japan was a Woman's Weekly World Cruise. Well, I think the point about that really was that probably 90% of the passengers were in their 90s. And I really think a lot of them were going to sea to die at sea, because two died at sea before we got there, before we got to Japan. But anyway, it wasn't the most enjoyable of sea voyages. It was all right. The voyage across to the Russian mainland was absolutely unbelievable. It was only a small ferry, and I've never been tossed around in a boat as much in my life. It was terrifying. The train trip was fascinating, if a little bit worrisome, if you like. Intourist was the Russian tourist organisation. They took your passport from you when you arrived, and they didn't give it back to you until you left, which means you travel right across mainland Russia with no ID papers at all, and that was quite disconcerting. But we made it, and then we got across Western Europe, got to London, and it took a while. I had to get a job to start with, working on a weekly regional in Uxbridge, out of London, and then I got a job with a wire service. It was a financial wire service, Universal News Services. Not quite in Fleet Street, New Fetter Lane, just off Fleet Street. That was close enough for me, and that was a learning curve too, because I had to suddenly sort of work out how to report company reports, annual reports, and business news, which again was something that up to that point I didn't know a hell of a lot about. But it was enjoyable, and we stayed there until deciding to head down to South Africa.
And how long was that before you went to South Africa?
I think we'd have gone down to South Africa in, I don't know if I say in my sheet, I'm sort of guessing a little bit, probably 70, 71, something like that.
Oh, yeah. So you were in London for a couple of years.
Not that long. Actually, I'd be wrong there. It would have been early 70 we'd have left, because we went down to South Africa. And I worked in South Africa for about 18 months too, before we then came back to Australia. My years are probably a little bit out here. If we came back to Australia, it would have been towards the end of 71. So we were in South Africa if not the end of 69, certainly early 70 and most of 71.
How did you feel being back in England?
Look, I enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed a pint. That's something I missed about England when I was, while I was here, and I still do to this day, a pint of English beer. And, of course, we took the opportunity to go up north and see my relatives and all of that sort of stuff. I enjoyed it, but I didn't find that I was saying to myself, God, I really want to come and live back here. I mean, that just didn't occur to me. I didn't want to come and live back here. I felt myself far more an Australian in England than an Englishman returning.
Okay.
Even though at that stage I didn't have citizenship, Australian citizenship, I was still very much a British subject. It was a good experience. It was worth doing, and we had great fun. But there was never any doubt in my mind that I wasn't going to stay there all that long. It was purely an experience trip.
Now, you were in South Africa at a very important and, I'd imagine, fascinating time, with all the anti-apartheid struggle happening. And did you report on those events at all?
Oh yeah, I first got a job. When we first got down to South Africa, and we travelled half the way there overland, across North Africa, we got a ferry from England down to Morocco, and then went overland by the cheapest means, through Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. Couldn't get into Libya, because at that stage, I think Gaddafi actually had probably just taken over, but the Brits were banned from Libya, so we had to get a ferry from Tunis across to Greece, Sicily, I think, and then from there get another ferry down to Alexandria. Then we went by boat and train, fourth class and deck class, down the Nile, all the way down the Nile to Juba in the southern Sudan. From there we had to fly to Entebbe because of the war, religious civil war that was going on in the southern Sudan, and had been going on for years. And then we got to Nairobi, and then from there we flew to South Africa, because my wife was 3 months pregnant at the time we did this trip, you see. So anyway, we lobbed in South Africa fairly broke. I think we had about £20 between us, and I had to get a job pretty quickly, which I was fortunate enough to do on the Rand Daily Mail, in the business section of the Rand Daily Mail.
Paul, did you, sorry to interrupt, but did you already have connections in South Africa?
No, none whatsoever, absolutely none whatsoever, no. I'd always wanted to go there. Lindy didn't. She thought South Africa was too much like Australia in terms of its geography and things like that. So it didn't sort of appeal to her. And part of the deal of going was that she said, all right, well, we'll go, but only if we go overland so we can see the rest of Africa. Yeah. That was partly it. But no, I got the job on the Rand Daily Mail, and I wasn't there very long, only really a matter of weeks, probably 6-8 weeks, because a position came up with Associated Press of America as one of its foreign correspondents based in Johannesburg. And of course, because my experience was basically wire services anyway, I jumped at that chance, and I got that job. And it was a wonderful job, and that was when... to go back to your direct question, obviously the international media was a lot more interested in what was going on vis-a-vis apartheid and the struggle for freedom, if you like, than was a lot of the press within South Africa itself. That's not to say the Rand Daily Mail wasn't a leader in that area. It was a very good leader in terms of human rights for South Africans, for black South Africans. And of course, that's probably one reason why the paper doesn't exist today. But yes, one graphic example, there was a, and this is how the South Africans used to manage to overplay everything, you know, that apartheid in those days was at its sort of obscene best, if you like. You know, they had park benches for whites only, they had public buses for whites only, toilets for whites only, and similarly for blacks only. I mean, it was total segregation. Obviously, any relationships across the colour line were completely and absolutely barred. You could get into deep trouble for having a relationship with a non-white if you were caught. And there was a demonstration I remember quite vividly down... the main street of Johannesburg, President Street, I think it was called, down towards the President Hotel anyway. Quite a few people there, and it was an anti-apartheid, peaceful march led by the Bishop of Johannesburg, the Anglican Bishop of Johannesburg, who was an elderly, frail gentleman, and he was out in the front of it all. And for no reason whatsoever, out came these khaki-clad South African police and absolutely beat into him. They hit him with batons, and of course he went down, and they just sort of left him there having done that. Well, of course, that was a good story, you know. And the other funny thing in a way was that we had to file, because you were filing via teleprinter through to London, and from London it was circulated on the Associated Press network worldwide. But to get anything through to London, you had to go through the main teleprinter communications network in Pretoria, and everything was monitored. So you put your tape in, click out your story, you put the tape in to send it, and if it was going to get blocked, bingo, the thing had suddenly stopped. So you try again, and boom, same thing had happened. You try one more time, boom, same thing had happened. And the South Africans obviously thought that they'd blocked you being able to send your story. Well, you just picked up the telephone and dialed it and dictated it through to London anyway. That used to happen quite a lot. You know, the so-called censorship, they'd say, oh, there's no censorship here, man. But there certainly was.
That incident on the demonstration, you were actually there.
Yeah,
you're talking from experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there were others. Not as direct as that, but the push was definitely gaining momentum. I mean, Forster was still Prime Minister. The the Afrikaners and the Nationalist Party still had a very strong grip on the way the country was run, and there was there was no momentum verging towards the violence at that point to you know, uprising against apartheid. It was still very much you know, the lid was kept on it, if you like, but the momentum was rising for public marches and things like that, and the international community was beginning to look much more at South Africa, whereas it had already started to look at Rhodesia. And one memorable occasion, we used to get sent, there were only three of us in the Associated Press office, and every now and again you'd get sent off on a mission into another country. We were covering nine Central and Southern African countries, and I got sent up to Rhodesia for the fifth anniversary of UDI, where it was old Ian Smith cracking the independence bell in the main street of Salisbury. And that was the key story to go and cover, which I did. But then if you were sent away on these missions, you had about 10 days, and the idea was that you'd have to do an economic situation around the country and how the country's economic situation's holding up, and then virtually anything else you could find that was would make a useful feature story. Well, they used to call them mailers. I learned about a guy who was a white farmer who lived about 150 miles out of Salisbury in the sticks, who was agitating very strongly, a very strong agitator for equal rights in Rhodesia. And I hired a car and off I went, and I met him and we had a long talk, and I got the story I was after. And a couple of people back in the local information office people in Salisbury had said, look, don't go, you know, they'd sort of tried to politely say don't do it, but I ignored them and off I went. And I came back and I had my story in my bag. But as I left to go fly back to Johannesburg, I walked out through immigration at Salisbury Airport, and these two guys in plain suits, white blokes, came up, and one of them just said, ah, Mr. Davey, I hope you enjoyed your stay in Rhodesia. And I said, yeah, it was very good, thanks very much. And he leant across to me and said, and don't you ever try to come back. Which was quite scary, quite scary.
Yeah.
And that was the reason, you know, they put tabs on you and things like that. But but that was memorable. Yeah.
And then back to South Africa from...
I just flew back to South Africa and filed the stories, and you know, that was that, basically. I heard no more of it.
Have you been back to South Africa?
Yeah. We went back... well, my eldest son, not long after we arrived there, I think... Lindy was probably 3 months pregnant when we first got to South Africa, 3 or 4 months pregnant. And he was born in Swaziland. Two reasons for that. One was because we weren't South African citizens or residents, the cost of hospitalisation in South Africa would have been very expensive. Whereas in Swaziland, she had to be a private patient at the Umbabani Hospital, and the cost of that was $2 a day. So that was there was an economic reason. The other point was, in the back of our minds, was the fact that we didn't necessarily, the way things were going, it didn't seem a very good idea to have a or to give your child a birth certificate in South Africa, whereas Swaziland was an independent Commonwealth country. Plus, it was a gorgeous little place, and it was great fun, and fortunately everything went well. So yes, we went back. We went back in 1985, partly to show our elder son Jim Swaziland, and we went around Swaziland, and we went around South Africa, and did the Kruger Park, and we went back to Salisbury, which by then, of course, was what do they call it now? Anyway, the country is no longer Rhodesia. Of course, it was it's Zimbabwe. And we went down to the Vic Falls, and then we flew out to London. Well, this was a holiday, and we left We left Zimbabwe, it was January, and it was the middle of summer, and it was as hot as hell, and we landed in London, and it was freezing, and there we were in summer clothes, you know. Yeah.
So you haven't been back to South Africa since Nelson Mandela was released? And
no, thing. I went back again in about 90... not 90. I went back again, and it would have been about 89, and no, I haven't been back since. I've been through it. We went through to, because our daughter worked in Botswana for quite a long time, and in 96, that's where I'm getting that date from, we went to Botswana, but we only literally flew into Joburg Airport and flew out again.
Now, you returned to Australia in late 71, you think, and I'm wondering, why did you decide to return then?
It was just a matter of, I think we both felt that it was time to go home. We'd been away for, 3 years or thereabouts or something like that. And, we both felt ready to come home. And, of course, Lindy had a son that she wanted to show her parents. They hadn't seen him before. So we came home. And I thought that, particularly having been a foreign correspondent for Associated Press and having worked in London, would stand me in pretty good stead, you know, getting work back in the media in Australia. It wasn't that easy at all. I ended up having to start off with take a job as a public relations officer with the NRMA in Sydney for a while. And, oh, God, that was terrible. It was so boring. It was bureaucratic, you know, if you drafted something, it had to be vetted by about 10 people in various divisions of the NRMA, and by the time it got back to you, you'd sort of look at it and think, well, it's not even worth talking about, not even worth putting it out. Mm. Fortunately, that didn't last too long, and I got a job with Channel 9. So I was moving into television, which I quite enjoyed, but I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy it because... quite understandably, television is pictorially based. So, you know, you're chasing fire engines more than anything else for the pictures of fires or the bits and pieces like that, rather than doing stories which might have some sort of meaning about them. I found that a bit boring. I also found very inhibiting the fact that in those days, when you're taking film and the sound, you had magstripe on film to produce the sound, and the sound was either 19 frames behind the picture. Now that was very inhibiting when it came to cutting and editing. So yeah, this is why you had to do noddies and all this sort of business, you know, to allow for time gaps and things like that.
Noddies being where
you stand in front of the camera and say nothing and nod your head, make it look meaningful and things like that. And the prime purpose of that was not just for a cutaway shot, but to enable an edit to be done with that 19 frame time lapse. I found it, compared to what I'd otherwise been doing, I found it quite restricting. But nonetheless, it was a good experience. It was good to know that. It was good to learn television. But I never felt particularly comfortable in television. I just felt I had been happy on wire services, and I guess I was thinking that's probably where I want to get back to.
Were you on camera?
Yeah. Paul Davey, Channel 9, Sydney.
That sounded good. And you also worked for ABC Radio during this period.
Yeah, well, because I wasn't all that comfy with television, I knew I didn't want to, my career path wasn't going to lie in television, and I happened to see in the Sydney Morning Herald, and it was a small ad for the ABC, wanted a reporter, I think it was a B grade reporter for its office in Port Hedland in Western Australia. And so I applied for it, and we thought, well, that'd be fun, go up to Port Hedland, see the Pilbara and the Kimberley and things like that, a bit parts of Australia we'd never seen before. I must have been the only applicant because I spelt Hedland HEADLAND when it should be HED, and I also addressed the application to the Australian Broadcasting Commission, And it had by then become the corporation. Now, I'm sure if there'd been any other applicants, I wouldn't have seen the light of day. But as it was, I got the job, and it was a fantastic job because I was based in Port Hedland. I had an ABC car. We had a house provided by the ABC with air conditioner in the bedroom because the breadwinner had to have a good night's sleep. No air conditioning anywhere else in the joint. It was fairly basic. But it was a one-man job, one-man operation, one-man office. When we first got there, we didn't even have television reception in Port Hedland in those days. It was radio only, but we had no broadcasting capacity out of Port Hedland. So I was effectively working, as it were, a wire service situation where I would get stories, I would file them down to Perth, and then they got broadcast from Perth back up to Port Hedland on the regional news or on the national or state news if the story was good enough. And again, because it was a one-man job, my territory basically went from the Northern Territory border down to about Carnarvon. It was the whole of that part of northwestern Australia. And I was given an enormous amount of latitude, you know, within reason. I was employed by news, the news department of the ABC. Therefore, my priority consideration had to be the news department. That's pretty obviously would do anyway because that's the immediacy. But I could also file for radio current affairs, for the rural department, the education department, virtually anything. And once you got into that area within the ABC, if you could vary your output across all avenues, there were huge opportunities that opened up, you know. And I did. I used to bludge rides with the aerial postman and with the flying doctor and go to the deep inland Aboriginal missions and get colour stories and this and that and all sorts of things. And it was just a fabulous job. And I did a lot of work also for the AM and PM programs, which must have been noticed by the hierarchy of radio current affairs in Sydney, because after I'd done the two-year appointment, and under the AJA award, then you had 5 weeks annual leave a year, and because it was a hardship posting, there was 2 weeks local leave, so that's 7 weeks, and you could accumulate the two lots of seven over the 2 years, so you could take 14 weeks, you know, just work straight and then take 14 weeks off straight, which is what I did, which then took us back overseas again and for another holiday, you know. And then I lobbed back into Sydney to go and see the ABC hierarchy on the way through, which is what was required. And I saw the head of radio current affairs, a guy called Russell Warner, who was quite an intimidating sort of a fellow. And he said, "Well, laddie, so you're on your way to Brisbane." And I said, "No, why would I be going there?" You know, he said, "Well, where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going back to Port Hedland." And he said, "Well, laddie, if you're going back to Port Hedland, it's only to pack a bag because you've been posted to Brisbane with AM and PM." It's the first I knew of it. So that's why how I ended up there. Yeah.
Yeah, you're certainly building up a very big curriculum detail in this period with travelling.
Yeah, it seemed to be the way to get on a bit in those days, although I didn't apply for that job with Radio Current Affairs. I'd been, Russell Warner headhunted me for it, and I was delighted to get it. I mean, it was a promotion. We were a bit sad to leave Port Hedland in a way, but we'd done a 2 year stint there, and in that part of the world, that is almost enough, you know. But it was a lot of fun, Port Hedland, hell of a lot of fun, and an absolute hole. We went back there only 2 or 3 years ago. It's a worse hole now, unfortunately, because they're all fly in, fly out people in the iron ore mines, whereas before they were people who were posted up, they went up there for a year or two. And if they got a house, well, they tried to build a garden out of it and maintain a bit of a garden. Now it's, you know, all of that's gone, and a lot of the housing up there sort of just falling apart a bit. I'd say now it's a complete dump, but it was a lot of fun, yeah.
And from Brisbane, is that when you came back to Canberra?
After Brisbane. After Brisbane. After Brisbane, yeah.
How long were you in Brisbane?
Right? In Brisbane for, 74, we got there in 74 after the floods, and we went down to Canberra, I'd say end of 77 or late 77. Yeah, in Brisbane, best part of 3 years or thereabouts, I suppose. That was great. The I mean, the key to success in working in radio current affairs in Queensland in those days was an ability to have access to Bjelke Petersen, the Premier, because he was a very colourful guy, apart from anything else. Also, after the 74 federal election, you started to get into the murky area of the loans affair with Gough Whitlam, and Joe was determined he was going to smash Whitlam and he was going to do it single-handedly. And he had this strange American bloke called Wiley Fancher up on the Atherton Tablelands who reckoned that he could crack the funny money trail. And I mean, there was a lot of political intrigue going on there at the time. And Joe, I got on very well with Joe, because Joe knew that the best way for him and the most immediate way for him to get his message nationwide around the country was through AM and PM, because they were totally national programs. They went to air right around Australia at the time. The only programs that actually did, you know, the news bulletins were sort of state-based and everything else. Joe wanted to get a message out into Western Australia. AM and PM was it. For my part, I knew that if I could get Joe on tape, I had every chance that my piece would get on air. So it was a good deal. It worked both ways. And I did get on well with him, not for any political reason, but I rather enjoyed Joe. And he was extremely good to me in terms of access. You know, yeah, he very rarely would he say, no, I'm not going to talk to you.
Were you becoming more political at this stage after these experiences?
Yes, I was. I think, although probably subconsciously a bit at the time, the Whitlam government, if you like, sort of arose a bit more of a political interest in me, in that up until his election, and from the time I'd been in the country, of course, it was the country had been under a Conservative coalition rule from Canberra for so long that it almost seemed sort of, almost impossible that there'd be anything else. And then Gough came in with a program of quite radical change. He wanted to change the fabric of the nation, basically, as far as I could see it. And I wasn't too sure that it needed changing that much. You know, everything, it was, to me, it was a case of, this guy, Whitlam, really wants to impose change for the sake of change, when really there's nothing broken anyway. So that sort of stirred my political interest a bit. But and of course, working with AM and PM involved me in a lot more political stories that were of a federal nature. So it was awakening in me, if you like. There were some... there were some not very edifying times. There was a Queensland Labor senator called Bertie Milliner who died, and his death precipitated Bjelke Petersen's appointment of Albert Field into the Senate, which tipped the Senate numbers potentially in favour of the coalition to block supply. Now, Bertie Milliner died, and I remember Gough came up for his funeral in Brisbane, and there was a whole stack of journos, of which I was one, and we were trying to get some comment out of Whitlam about what he thought about the replacement for Bertie Milliner and these sorts of things, and would he be calling an election? Because the hype was getting up there at this stage. And of course, Gough wasn't going to say anything, but you had this rather unedifying scene of us reporters literally pointing microphones at Whitlam across Milliner's coffin as it came out of the church. it wasn't very nice at all, but these things happened. Then, of course, you know, Gough, at the time of the dismissal, I was in the office around midday, about 1 o'clock, the telephone rang. It was my producer, PM producer in Sydney, who just said, Gough's been dismissed. Radio Current Affairs are taking over the airwaves. We can butt into any program throughout the whole afternoon. Get out there, get reaction, and feed it in. And the program just sort of went on an ongoing basis. And you'd get reaction from people on the street. Of course, the first target was Joe. What was Joe's reaction, you know? And I got that. And in those days, we had quite a big, sizable, heavy Nagra tape recorders. They were beautiful old things. They were great to use in a demonstration because you could get a swing up on them off your shoulder and get people out of the way. But, you know, you'd get a piece away, for instance, with Joe, and to get it back down to Sydney, you'd hit the pinch button on the thing, you'd line up the tape, hit the pinch button. Well, before you did that, actually, get a public telephone, unscrew the front of it, put the alligator clips onto the mouthpiece part of it, plug it into the tape recorder. Then you get your tape lined up and you hit the pinch pin, turn her on, and you're on the phone, sort of half listening to it here with the mouthpiece hanging out, you know, and suddenly the producer at the other end will say, right, okay, and now we cross to Paul Davey in Brisbane, who's just been talking to the Queensland Premier, Bjelke Petersen. You let the tape go and she'd fire off down the line, you know, hit the tape again at the end. Off you go, do the next bit and back you go. You know,